All right, looks like we have a pretty full house. Good afternoon. Welcome to the first webcast being brought to you by the Georgia Society of CPAs Insurance Services section. Before we get started, I just want to quickly acquaint everybody with how the webcast is going to run. Today we have a panel of three speakers, and questions will be welcome throughout the discussion. However, I have muted the telephone line, so these questions will initially only be allowed in a text format by typing them into the question box in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. At the end of the webcast, there will be an open Q&A session where I will actually unmute the telephone lines and we'll actually take questions through the phone lines at that point. Today's webcast offers attendees 2 credits of CPE. However, in order for attendees to qualify for this credit, you need to answer the polling slides that we've actually inserted into the presentation throughout. If you do not answer the polling slides, you're actually not going to get CPE credit for the webcast today. For all the polling questions, there's no correct answer and there's no wrong answer, but it's just more important that you actually answer the polling slide itself. Also, after today's webcast, we're going to be emailing out evaluations to everyone who attended, and we strongly recommend that you fill out the evaluations so we have an idea of how the webcasts are perceived by the membership and what's a good way to proceed from there. So without further ado, we're going to go ahead and get started. As I mentioned, we have a panel of 3 speakers. And I'm going to be covering the introduction. My name is Don Cook. I am Sections Manager with the Georgia Society of CPAs. And Chris Rouse will be covering the background. And Chris is with Wyndham Brannan. Greg Kredecki, who's with Clayton State University, is actually going to be covering the what's new in the risk assessment standards and give everybody an overview of what's new in the standards. And then we're going to cap it off with how to maximize the opportunities for efficiency. And both Chris Rouse and Bill Godshall will be covering that portion. And Bill's with Fraser and Dieter. And we thought we'd actually jump right into a polling slide, and we want to get your feedback on, you know, kind of where attendees lie in your, as far as if you've taken a course in the risk assessment standards, so we can get a feel for where everybody who's attending this webcast is. So if you could actually start out by answering this question, and the polling slides are very simple. You just want to actually answer yes or no. And as I mentioned earlier, it's more important that you actually answer the poll slide rather than the actual answer to it, because this is, again, what qualifies you for CPE. So the question for this one is, have you taken a course in a new risk assessment standards? And you have to answer yes or no to this. So if you could go ahead and actually start answering yes or no, and you'll see the results display on the right-hand side, and that'll give attendees an idea for where everybody is as well. While everybody's filling this out, I'm going to quickly introduce the speakers today. As I mentioned, we have Chris Rouse with us. Chris is an audit partner with and the firm audit and accounting quality control partner at Wyndham Brannan, which is an Atlanta, Georgia CPA firm. Chris has taught at various AICPA as well as Georgia Society events covering audit risk assessment courses, and he's done this in numerous locations, both locally and nationally. Also joining us is Bill Godshall. Bill joined Fraser and Dieter in 2005 after leaving the PCAOB, where he served as inspection leader. His areas of specialty include working with large and middle market companies in the public and private sector. And Bill's experience at the PCAOB make him uniquely qualified to lead an insurance engagement in today's environment, as well as take part in this webcast today. And then we also have Greg Kordecki, and Greg is Associate Professor of Accountancy at Clayton State University in Morrow, Georgia, and is a technical review partner for Kushner & Associates, which is a Marietta, Georgia CPA firm. Greg has presented papers at regional and national conferences, published in international journals, and served on executive and standing committees for the Georgia Society of CPAs. All 3 panelists are very active in the Georgia Society, and specifically with the insurance services section. So without further delay, I'm going to actually hand the microphone over to Chris, and he's going to take it from here.
All right. Thank you, Don. Appreciate it. One thing to clear up is that there's folks think that the risk assessment standards are, in fact, new. Actually, they have been in process for a good long while. They go back even to the pre-Enron days, although certainly the Enron bankruptcy did, in fact, inspire the Auditing Standards Board, I think, to proceed more quickly with regard to it. There was an exposure draft out even before Sarbanes-Oxley came about, but the Auditing Standards Board decided to hold up with final issuance of any standards until the TCAOB had determined what it was going to do with respect to the establishment of auditing standards. And once it became clear that TCAOB was going to be the establisher of generally accepted auditing standards for public companies, then the Auditing Standards Board began to proceed again to get the to re-expose these new standards so that the practitioners would be using an approach to their audit in the non-public arena that was very similar to the approach that was being used in the public arena. There was a great concern on the part of the Auditing Standards Board that the audits done in accordance with generally accepted auditing standards not be perceived as a second-class audit, as somehow a lesser audit than an audit of a public company, an audit done in accordance with the PCAOB rules and regulations. And so as part of that conformity, if you will, of the generally accepted auditing standards to the PCAOB standards, there were some changes that were made in the initial exposure draft of the new standards. And as a result of that re-exposure and accepting those additional comments in March of 2006, the Auditing Standards Board issued the new auditing standards. They are effective for audits for periods beginning after 12/15/2006, which means that if you have done any audits that had a short period, for instance, if you did an audit for the 6 months ended June the 30th of 2007, then they would have been effective because it's for periods beginning after and a period beginning on January 1st and ending on June 30th of 2007 then would be subject to that. We tend to think of these as being effective for audits with years ending 12/31/07 for that. And, in fact, if you're doing a full 12-month audit on the income statement, that would, in fact, be the first time that they're effective. Of course, to the extent that you are currently planning those audit engagements, then these are the standards that you need to be using for purposes of complying with the standards for audits for those years ending 12/31/07. We have now Greg Kordecki here is going to take us through a due professional care. Before we do that, however, I want to go to a second polling question so that we can get some idea of what the audience is with respect to the nature of your practices. And so this is just a simple question about how many audits does your firm perform each year, 0 to 5, 6 to 15, or more than 15 audits that you're performing. If you would please take a moment to respond to that question before Greg starts his part of the presentation. All right, Greg, if you would, please.
Okay, thank you, Chris. Before we go into the individual overview of the 8 standards in this risk assessment bunch, just a little bit of a recall here in terms of the names of these standards and where we're heading for. And essentially, number 104 is the first in the battery of 8 going through 111. Of course, there's been other SASs issued since then, but they're not formally part of this grouping. And any time the Auditing Standards Board has come out with a group, it's something that's phenomenal and large. The expectation gap standards, as some of us can recall, it came out in the 1980s, was a fairly decent change, and this is as well. Going from the very first one, 104, amending due professional care, we won't speak too much to that, nor will we to the last one, number 111, on the amendments of the audit sampling. However, they are important, and the ones in between are extremely important to us because they deal with what we do on a day-to-day basis. They address the standards of field work as well as the general standards, and probably as well the implications for changes in the way we conduct our work and the way we go ahead and actually bill out our services, and we'll find out whether or not we're being more efficient. 104 is the first in the list on due professional care. Other ones will deal with audit evidence, materiality, planning and supervision, all tied to the concept of risk, understanding the entity and its environment, and performing the audit procedures in response to these assessed risks. Number 104, amends due professional care, expands the definition of reasonable assurance. There is a call for high but not absolute assurance. Again, we're focusing here on the user's needs and expectations. As Chris has mentioned, there's been some good filtering that has come down from both the Securities Exchange Commission as well as from the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board influencing this definition. 105, amending the standards of field work. This expands the scope of understanding of the entity and its environment, including its internal control. No longer can we simply go ahead and assess control risk at a maximum. We need to, if we're going to go that high, have clear documentation in terms of why such a measure is being taken. So there's an overall emphasis on all these standards for increased documentation of our work. Emphasizes a link between understanding the entity, assessing risks, and designing audit programs. Notice the fact here is that we're emphasizing audit programs, not just an overall strategy. It's also anticipated that some of the more generic audit programs that some of us are using may not be totally appropriate for the use of trying to meet the standards that we see them today. We may have to adjust some of those programs to meet the standards as they exist. 106 on the audit evidence. Notice the fact that the standard itself is named audit evidence. Some of us can recall the need for obtaining sufficient, competent, evidential matter. Now we're cutting right to the chase here and calling that audit evidence. These tools, again, can all be customized and tailored to the needs of our clients, and that's one of the major focuses of these risk assessment standards, is to be able to go ahead and gather, accumulate, document, record the types of material that we need to, and that's not to overkill and over-document, but to do the right thing efficiently. Inquiry alone is not sufficient to evaluate the design of controls or financial reporting and to determine whether they have been implemented. Therefore, there's a big emphasis, like there was in the SAS 99 on the fraud, for walkthroughs of significant processes to determine whether these controls have actually been implemented. So there's some follow-through on this. We also see that the audit evidence standard is recategorizing the traditional management assertions that previously had been just a simple linear list, and now we have three categories, and probably for a good reason. We're going through to more of a cycle approach, and basically we're looking at transactions, recording, booking the entries, and what are the sorts of events that would possibly be leading to management's assertions behind these. The general ledger account balances has a separate group, and then also finally the output of the cycle being the financial statements with its related footnote disclosure. And of course we'll notice as well that some of these three categories have duplicate assertions. 106 also requires the auditor to design and perform substantive procedures for all relevant assertions related to each material class of transactions account balances and disclosures to obtain sufficient appropriate, new word, appropriate audit evidence. This includes the standard testing of revenues and expenses if material. The tendency to simply do for the smaller practitioner the balance sheet audit without looking at the P&L accounts is clearly out the window. Risk assessment is more than simply management inquiries, but it includes management inquiries. It also includes the analytical procedures. It includes observation and inspection. Number 107, tying together audit risk with materiality. We still have the traditional multiplicative model of taking the inherent risk times the control risk times the detection risk to gain an overall audit risk. However, the inherent control risk can be somewhat accumulated. We know that the client is and the industry are essentially behind those risks, whereas the auditor on a detection risk. Again, setting at a maximum automatically without documentation is not permissible. Materiality is based on the user's needs and the maximum amount of error that can be tolerated in the financials, and we still have being a matter of professional judgment. However, we go further than that. The standard documents the basis for materiality and tolerable misstatement determination. This requires the auditor to request management to record any past adjusting journal entries and provides guidance regarding known and likely misstatements. So 107 has a powerhouse of material in here for us. Moving on to 108, planning and supervision. Notice another requirement, not just a should or possibly could, but a definite requirement now in the profession for the engagement letter on the front end of the work. Also consideration of communication of audit strategy and timing with those charged with governance and management, and the standard goes further to continue the other existing requirements. SAS 109, understanding the entity and assessing risks. This requires obtaining understanding of the entity and its environment. Understanding the entity and its environment does include control environment, risk assessment, information and communication systems, control activities, and monitoring. Again, all of this information that is here leads to the idea or concept of follow-through of the walkthrough. Evaluating design and determination if controls have been implemented allows for relying on controls other than the segregation of duty. So again, it's the tone at the top as well. Understanding the entity and assessing risk also calls for an audit planning meeting. Most of us are probably are doing that, but the formalization of the planning meeting is important. It should be attended by an auditor with final responsibility for the audit and ask what can go wrong types of questions. So it's a personal inquiry here as well. Assess the risk of material misstatement at the financial statement and assertion level. So we're doing both the macro and micro on this. And designing audit programs, not simply overall audit strategies, but a specific program. And the risk assessment procedures must be performed. SAS 110, response to assessed risks, raises a different type of audit planning. This should not be completed until after the understanding, implementation, and the testing is complete. May need to consider any control testing. The list of overall response considerations has been expanded. Performing tests of controls when it is more efficient than just substantive tests. When not possible for substantive tests alone to reduce the risk of material misstatements to appropriately low level. We may rely on tested on-change controls for the next two audits. If relying on controls, we must test some controls in each audit. I guess the impetus here is do the right thing, go after what we need to go after, do not go after things which are certain, go and design your program to look for those items which are uncertain. Also, a call for clear linkage between risk assessment and planned audit procedures. Increasing the extent of audit procedures will not compensate for procedures that do not address the identified risk of misstatement. Perform tests for all relevant assertions related to each class of material transactions, balances, and disclosures. And here we tie things to the ultimate product, that is the financial statement level, of agreeing financial statements and footnotes to the underlying accounting records, examining management's material journal entries, and adjustments made during the course of preparing the financials. And finally, number 111, tolerable misstatement is the maximum error in a population that the auditor is willing to accept. The standards do not use the expression individually significant items. And this does essentially amend parts of the old SAS 39 on audit sampling and includes some of the verbiage as well, referencing SAS 99 on fraud. I believe at this point we are up for another polling question or, okay.
Right, there we go. If we can get an idea as to what your impression is of what the effect of all these changes are on your audit practice are going to be, and whether you have given serious consideration to it or not, that would, if you would please respond to that. All right, that's a good mix. Looks like the preponderance of it is in that 1 to 15% increase. There are a few folks who believe there might actually be a decrease in the audit time as a result of going to these new standards. We're going to have to do a lot of new things. There are new forms and checklists associated with this process. Those of us who use the various purchase practice aids that are available for used by practitioners have probably had an opportunity at this point to see some of those. There is certainly a lot of additional documentation that's going to be required, and clearly documentation does take time. If you only thought it before, that was pretty quick, and now you're actually going to have to write things down. It's going to take more time to do that. You have a planning meeting that you have to take now. Whether you have done that in the past or not, I suspect that the length of that planning meeting is going to be increased if you have been holding them in the past as a result of these new standards. Materiality documentation is going to take more time. No longer can you go to the box and do the math to come up with what is material to your client's financial statements. You're now going to have to actually make assessments with respect to that materiality on every audit, and each one would be different. Clearly, your internal control understanding is going to be powered up a good bit from what it may have been in the past, and I suspect that the documentation associated with that is going to take more time. There may be a future use of that is where you don't have to recreate the wheel. You only have to deal with changes, but clearly in this first year, there are going to be some important changes in our time there. You're going to have to do walkthroughs now. Those are not optional. You're required to do walkthroughs of all the significant processes in the client. So how many of those you have to do and how you do those is going to have to be carefully thought out, I think. You're going to have to make a risk assessment of every account, of every objective, to the extent that those items are material and relevant to the client's financial statements. That's more than we have been doing in the past, and the process for doing that is going to take more time than others would also. Now, you're going to have to tailor your audit programs. I think we've been doing that at one level or another in the past, but I believe that in the future, the consequences of the new standards make it very clear that generic audit programs are not going to work. And so we're going to have to be spending time, at least initially, in developing these greater tailoring associated with the audit programs. And then finally, we're going to have to be doing our communication with management and those charged with governance. While that's outside of the risk assessment standards, it is still a new standard 112, which follows, and we have 114 coming into play this year, which requires not only communication of material weaknesses and significant deficiencies, but also calls for communications with management and those charged with governance at a different level. So I think that it's going to be. Now, in presentations that I've done and talking with other people, the general consensus is that this is going to cause an increase in the audit time of somewhere between 10% and 20%. And I think that's consistent with what we've seen in the polling question that we just had for you. There are also others that have actually implemented these risk assessment procedures through some commercially available and supervised programs, that their experience has been that generally if they have a practice of more than 10 or 20 audits, that they are actually seeing a reduction in the time, because what they're doing is focusing on risk and they are not doing those procedures that we have all done in the past simply because they are in the standard or CAM programs that we use. And so it's actually through the elimination of that, of those program steps, that we're probably going to have the opportunity for those changes. We have a lot of new forms that we're going to have to deal with as part of this. I suspect that you need to have some CPE, and it appeared that most of you have had more than this meeting in training for the new standards. There's a very direct connection between the forms and checklists that many of us use and that are available from the various purveyors of these purchase practice aids to the new standards. But if you don't comprehend and understand and apply these new forms and checklists in that context, then the context of the new standards, then I think you're at risk of spinning your wheels, for spending more time than you really need to be spending to achieve the objective that the new standards are really focused on. So I would look for that to figure out how to use those efficiencies, to put together a roadmap of these new forms. And so you can list the Form 1 and the Form 2 and how you're going to use it and when you're going to complete it. A lot of these new forms, you complete the Form number 6 before you complete the Form number 4, for instance. And so develop a roadmap and how far you're going to drill down into these new forms to deal with them. The workflow is very different than the form flow in these things. Use electronic versions, clearly, to the extent that provides you the opportunity to roll this information over next year. That's going to be, I think, a big benefit for you. And other matters that are available inside some of these electronic versions. And obviously also to consult frequently, to discuss it with other practitioners as we all work through the development and the use of all these new items to figure out how in the world we're going to put all these things together. There's also additional documentation that you need. We're trying to figure out and put together a reviewer's checklist, if you will, so that we can see where these new areas for documentation are, so that we can communicate that as part of a planning meeting, so that we can communicate that as part of the review processes, so that the staff who are actually doing the work understand what's different from last year. Sally works for us. I'm sure she works for a lot of you also. And I think that we're going to have to revise some of those things that Sally did last year so that we can put it in the proper perspective and in the proper provide the proper documentation of it in the current year. There is, in fact, a need for a continuous audit program, so it's a live document during the course of the audit. To the extent that you uncover unexpected items or potential errors, then the development and written instructions, a written program with respect to how you're going to approach that matter needs to be certainly very much in hand so that you can deal with that effectively. With that, I will turn it over to Bill to talk about other ways we can maximize this efficiency as part of the conduct of the planning meeting.
Thank you, Chris. While the planning meeting is a required step under the new standards, it's also referred to as a brainstorming session and other references, the planning meeting also represents a key opportunity to obtain some efficiencies with the new audit risk standards. In the planning meeting, this is where you sit down principally with the person who is charged with responsibility for the audit. That would generally be the person signing the financial statements and ultimately responsible for the final opinion. And this is also going to be your person with the most experience, typically with an audit engagement, maybe a particular recurring client. So you would use your planning meeting to identify the risks and your planned audit response to those risks. One thing you can do as a sort of a memory jog or an aid is to ask yourself, if you had one day to do the audit, how would you do it? And that is, you would focus on the risks that require special attention, which the new SAS is referred to as significant risks. So while you may have some low risks, some moderate risks, and high risks, there's also those significant risks that require special attention. If you only had one day to do the audit, those would be the risks that you would concentrate your efforts on. You would tailor your canned procedures to deal with those risks since you know what they are and you know how you want to address them. And as Chris mentioned, the idea of using previously written programs may not be appropriate to address the requirement to tailor a program in the current period. The other thing you would do with these risks in a one-day audit is that you would get focused on them as soon as possible. You would start moving early. Now, in a real audit, you have more than one day, but the concepts are all still the same. You focus on the risks that have the most uncertainty and that could lead to the greatest possibility of resulting in misstatements in the financial statements. You tailor your tests accordingly to address those risks both in an effective and an efficient manner. You want to effectively address the risk, but you don't want to spend more time on those risks than is necessary to properly test. You know, in other words, you know, over-testing something yields you no additional information, so you try to plan a proportionate response to your assessed level of risk. So one of the things to consider in part of your planning meeting, and in our firm, we've actually broken up the planning meeting to a couple of stages. We have sort of a pre-planning meeting where we sit down with management, and, you know, in our planning meeting, we're asking the what can go wrong questions. So in a properly controlled organization, management should be asking this question. And so ask management, what keeps you up at night? Okay, if that keeps you up at night, how do you address those concerns? What are the tools and what are the means that you use to ensure that these potential problems or potential control deficiencies are addressed, and what steps have you taken to address these risks? There's an opportunity there to piggyback off of what management's doing. This is an area maybe we can identify some key controls to evaluate either in our walkthrough process or if we decide to do control testing to focus on those controls. These wouldn't necessarily be simple control activities. They could be monitoring controls. They could be information technology responses to management's problems. You also use a meeting with management to address the purpose and limitations of the audit. While the engagement letter will formally document that process, it's probably better to also have that conversation with management face-to-face and an opportunity to give them an opportunity to ask you questions. The other thing to remember as you go through a discussion of risk and plan responses, try to determine if there are opportunities to assist your client. Accounting assistance, when it's properly structured, should be a separate engagement not related to the audit. And we'll go into this a little bit more in a later section of the presentation. But the idea here is that auditing is about uncertainty, not certainty. So if you know something is wrong or the client knows they need help with something, then it's important to start talking in the planning stage about how the client's going to fix that area. And that might be an area where they need your assistance. If you can carve those hours out and put them into an accounting assistance engagement instead of an audit engagement, then you might have an opportunity to avoid unnecessary hours. Of course, it's important to remember the independent standards and the ethics interpretations when you structure these assistance program engagements to make sure that you stay within the bounds allowed by the professional standards. As you go through your planning meeting, you want to consider the work that was done in prior years. This is obviously stuff that's not really new, but given the new risk standards, this is an opportunity to take a fresh look and a sort of a bottom-up look. Do we really need to perform each of these steps that we performed in the past? You know, you may find, based on the current risk assessment, you might have performed more procedures than were really necessary in light of your current risk assessment. You may also be able to identify ways to perform the work more efficiently. Remember, you're going to tailor an audit program this year, hopefully from the bottom up, whereas in the past you've taken a canned audit program response And, you know, you might have a lot of NAs on there, and you might have a few handwritten in steps in there that you needed to do because the program didn't address exactly what you wanted to do. This is that opportunity to take a fresh look at what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. You can also find ways that your client can help you with their schedules. There's a pretty good chance that if you need to schedule, the client should already have something in their possession or something in their process that addresses that schedule. If they don't prepare that schedule and you need it, there's a good chance they might need it too. And here's a chance that you've brought some value to your client in pointing out a better way to run their organization, a better way to control their organization. You know, also, it gives you an opportunity as you identify your specific risks if your staff on the engagement could benefit from some self-study preparation in regards to those certain areas of risk. It makes your staff better prepared as they enter into the year-end testing phase of the audit engagement. And, of course, technology can always be available to improve the efficiency of these engagements. Chris mentioned the use of electronic work papers, the ability to roll forward those work papers, the ability to share information depending on which platforms you use. At our firm, we are able to share documented information from one form to the next form to the next form, including our audit programs, so that we don't have to keep entering the same information 2, 3, 4 times over. And we found some scale and efficiency in that process. When you're planning the engagement, you may find that you can address certain accounts using your preliminary procedures, including some early testing and maybe some substantive analytics and a risk assessment process. This may not be the most efficient use of your time, but because it allows you to pull time out of busy season and into sort of what I would call the planning season right now, it might be a better use of that person's time and allow you to perform more efficiently during a busy season period. Another thing that's really important about the planning meeting from a client service perspective is this is an opportunity where you can identify potential manager letter recommendations. If you had problems addressing FAST 112 last year, as many of us did, you could get a sense of what your significant deficiencies and material weaknesses might be. And obviously, anytime you can raise these issues with management early, as opposed to the day you give them the opinion and rep letter, I think you have a happier client. May not have a happier client on your hands, but you have a less upset client on your hands. And more importantly, it gives them an opportunity to address those areas of concern that you have as an auditor in your risk assessment process, particularly regarding significant deficiencies and material weaknesses, to give them a chance to remediate and to quantify what those risks might mean and how you can address those risks. And sometimes your client will have good feedback and good responses for you to consider in that process. So, you know, it gets down to the early communication of problems that you expect to encounter, and the best way to assess that is through the planning meeting after you've gathered your information. And, you know, at the end of our engagement is sometimes when we wait to communicate all this stuff, the exit conference or, you know, the communication of, you know, of matters to those charged with governance and so forth. But it's never too early to begin planning for that exit conference with your client. And depending on the nature and severity of the issues that you've identified, it's never too early to discuss those as you conclude your risk assessment procedures. The next area we want to move on to is materiality determination. You know, materiality has been around as long as auditing, I guess, and you know the key about materiality is it recognizes that some matters are more important than others for the fair presentation of financial statements. That's basically the guidance included in the AICPA handbook regarding the concept of materiality. And materiality drives our audit process. It's our way of putting a quantitative or measure on risk and creating a benchmark for procedures that need to be performed in response to those risks. In the past, at least in my personal experience, I think there's been too much emphasis on generating a quantitative score for materiality, including the box that most of us are familiar with using. Qualitative factors are just as important as quantitative factors, particularly when you start recognizing that materiality needs to be assessed from the perspective of the users of the financial statements. You need to ask yourself, who are the users of my financial statements and what's important to them? So if you're auditing a software company, as an example, revenues are probably more important than total assets or even net assets or equity. So at what point would a user become concerned with differences in revenue? Probably not 1%, almost certainly somewhere between 3 and 5%. And maybe, but definitely somewhere between that 2 to 3%, your users would start to say, wow, okay, if revenue is that far off, that might cause me to make a different decision about this organization or this entity. So use that qualitative process to arrive at a quantitative number instead of simply walking through a quantitative box that's a one-size-fits-all. And you may find yourself, depending on the nature of the organization, the controls at your organization, the understanding you've gained of that entity and how they operate, that certain percentage thresholds are more appropriate for certain organizations. You may have different investor classes or needs of groups where 1% is more important than 2% or 3%. And the key in this, as mentioned by Greg earlier, is materiality and our basis for materiality needs to be documented in the planning process. It's an important concept in the standards. I think I got a little ahead of myself, and now we're ready for the, Chris, you're going to talk a little bit about the understanding of internal control?
Great, and just to follow up on the materiality determination, I think that's an important part for efficiency that we may not understand, may not have applied or considered that as well. We have just started in our firm to go through the determination of materiality on our audits. And what we're finding is that the materiality number is increasing importantly over what it was when we were working inside the box. And the both the Auditing Standards Board, as it in its conjunction with the peer review information, and the PCAOB as part of its inspections, had made determination that the use of a pre-printed number that was a certain percentage related to a certain asset or liability or revenue type item was just not getting the right answer with respect to materiality on the financial statements, because enterprises in the same industry with the same revenue can have very different materiality numbers relative to those financial statements. An example I frequently use is when we look at a not-for-profit entity, for instance, and we focus on, well, what is it that's important to users? Who are the users, first of all? And we come to a conclusion that one important user of not-for-profit financial statements are potential contributors. And so if they are potential contributors, then they're not interested a whole lot in the past. What they're interested in is the future. And so to the extent that the expenditures of that not-for-profit entity are materially different or materially inaccurate, if you will, then that would be important too. That could be what's important to those potential contributors. And so we would take a look at it and normally, if you would be careful about what's normal, but normally 80% of a not-for-profit expenditures are for its purpose or for its mission. And what we looked at was, well, what if it was 79% or 81%? Do you think that would change your user's mind with respect to that piece of information? And the answer generally was, well, no, probably not. Well, how about 78 to 82? Would that 2% difference, would that matter? And that takes you a moment to think about. 3%, absolutely. At 3%, it's certainly. So we go back then to the number that we were very comfortable with is 1% of expenditures. In a not-for-profit environment, expenditures generally equals the revenue. That's why they're called not-for-profits. And so if you look at the box that we use in the past, the materiality number that we were coming up with was somewhere between 1/2 or a little bit less than that percent, 1/2 of 1% of the total revenues. And so now we're looking at a 1% number. And so all of a sudden, our materiality has doubled when we focus on what the users are. And when you apply that same principle to others, other companies and the commercial end of it, I think you'll begin to see that there is an opportunity for efficiency that's coming out of this judgment, that we have to apply, professional judgment that we have to apply in making a determination as to what materiality is. going on then to the internal control understanding that we have to do, there are more forms than we've had in the past. At the same time, those additional forms still follow the same purpose that we had with respect to the old forms that we're using. And I think that the best way to get the efficiency out of that is to make sure that you get the client to fill out a lot of those checklists, that you get the client to even prepare the narrative with respect to what their accounting processes are all about. And you remember that inside this internal control, we're now broken down between the tone at the top and the processing and the information and the communication systems. And so the client has a lot of that information already prepared inside their organization. And to maximize that use of that information, I believe, is probably going to be a good way to use efficiency or to maximize the efficiency with respect to this greater or larger understanding that I think we're going to have over what we've probably had in the past. I think you also need to look at the question of testing of internal control and to think about those areas where you're going to be using sampling. And so if you look at accounts receivable, if you're sending out 100 accounts receivable, by identifying a key control that is relevant to the existence objective, then I think that you could probably cut your testing in approximately one half. It is only send out 50. And so that's probably worthwhile. On the other hand, if you're sending out 10 confirmations and cutting it in half is only going to be sending out 5, then the time it takes you to do an internal control test in order to get that much more efficiency, that is 5 fewer confirmations, is probably not worth the time that you would need to. And understand that internal control testing is all about efficiency. Other than one minor exception, which is probably not applicable in most of our practices, you do not have to do internal control testing. It is not required, and the standards are very clear that you would only do that internal control testing. You're only required to do, you would only want to do that internal control testing when it would reduce the total time that you're going to be spending on the audit. Think about your inventory price testing work. If you have an enterprise that has a multiple standard cost system or that has multiple products that have different prices on them in a wide range, so that you're going to have to price test 10 or 20 or 30 items in inventory. If by doing a test of the key control that makes sure that their pricing is correct, you could recut that in half, which is approximately the number you'll get, and we'll look at that a little bit later. And so that would then allow you to achieve enough efficiency by reducing the total time you're going to spend to offset the time that you spend in doing the internal control testing. There are also instances where, as a matter of adding value to the audit, what we have found in our practice is that we like to test internal control sometimes, even though the total time savings may not be as great, because then we can identify risk and communicate that to the client better. And so the additional time savings is not always just exactly what you want to use. I think there's a real opportunity to add value to the clients that's associated with some internal control testing to be able to do that. The subsequent disbursement arena is another area where we have an opportunity, I think, to reduce the scope, to reduce the size, the number of items that we have with respect to looking at the client's cutoff work to be able to do that. During the walkthrough, first of all, I would suggest you practice it before you go to the client and do that. That's we've instituted a process in the firm where we actually conduct some training in how to do these interviews or how to do some of these walkthroughs. Yeah, I was speaking with the firm the other day where the partner actually did the walkthrough so that he could learn what the process was about and bring it back. And it took him 2 days to do the walkthrough, and in conversation with him, we discovered that, you know, probably on an ongoing basis, it's about a four-hour walkthrough to be able to walk through these transactions. But the one thing you're going to have to figure is whether to do the walkthrough at the transaction level or whether to do it at the account level. And you remember our assertions are now broken down by those three different classes, and the first one is classes of transactions. So those are revenues and expenditures, as opposed to account balances, which are balance sheet driven. And what we found is that the cycles, if you will, for the classes of transaction are more appropriate to do the walkthrough with respect to determining whether or not the controls have been implemented. And so we do a revenue cycle, which covers accounts receivable and sales, as well as all of the accounts that go along and support those. The expenditure cycle, of course, would be accounts payable and cost of goods sold and other expenses and all of the accounts that go along with that. The treasury cycle involves debt. It involves investments as well as some financial statement prep. So those are the treasury. That's where the treasury cycle is. And you may need to think about it that way rather than about cash or accounts receivable or other things. On the other hand, it does become useful sometimes to look at it at the account level. For instance, you may determine by doing some implementation work, that is some walkthroughs, with respect to cash, then you can obtain some assurance that cash as stated would be proper to the extent or those controls that have been implemented reduce the risk. And that means that you can do less work with respect to cash. You can become focused on what the higher risks are in cash and deal with those risks. As to the timing, you would want to look at the number of transactions that you have to walk through. What we found is that a fairly small number, that is two or three or four, is the number that we use with respect to it. And there is no requirement in the standards. As a matter of fact, the standards are very explicit that you do not have to actually record the invoice numbers or the sales numbers or anything like that that you actually use. The standards are speaking very specifically about documenting that type of information when you're doing control testing. But in all the discussion of the walkthrough area, there's no mention of that level of documentation. So if you can walk through a transaction from beginning to end in one day, then that may be how you would do it. On the other hand, you may want to take a look at the receiving area, that is where the orders come in. When I mean receiving area, the place where the telephone is logged or the customers walk in the door or the mail comes in, whatever that initiation process is. And so looking at that and observing and inquiring and doing analytics becomes, but then when you get to the end where they actually collect the cash, it's not possible to look at those same transactions just as a matter of timing. So you're going to have to figure out how you have done that. And we've discovered that the use of a walkthrough program is very useful in helping the staff deal with those walkthroughs, particularly as you start doing them initially. In terms of the periods covered, the idea is that that you need to know as a result of these walkthroughs whether or not the controls that you are looking at were implemented for the period under audit. And that means that if you do them as of a preliminary basis, you need to make sure that they were in effect at the beginning of the year. You also need to make sure at some point that they're still in effect at the end of the year. And you can do that with inquiry under the standards. You don't have to re-walk through as of the client's year end. In fact, you can do that walkthrough after the client's year end, so long as when you're doing the walkthrough, it is done to achieve the understanding as to whether or not that control was in place and had been implemented throughout the period under audit, and that it's not something new that they've added or that they quit doing some important control that would be relevant to the period of time. And so that's what you're trying to be able to achieve as you're doing these walkthroughs in terms of the number of transactions and the periods covered and here's where the advantage is. This is the chart that we're all very used to. This is actually out of the risk assessment standards course that the AICPA developed. And so this chart is not unique to the some of the purchase practice aid folks. And you'll notice that the items in the red color there are the internal control questions. What we have been doing in the past is defaulting our control risk to the max, which is 3. And if you remember, we usually take the inverse of that, and that's 1/3, and that's the number that we use in order to assess the number of transactions that we're going to be looking at. We take 1/3 of our materiality or tolerable and make sure that that's the transaction size that we look at. Well, by virtue of knowing that controls have been implemented, I no longer have to assess the risk at the max. I can assess it at less than the max. I can't assess it as low unless I actually test for those controls to make sure that they are effective. There's two tests of internal controls. And so, but I can go to 1.9. Now, the inverse of 2 would be 1/2 as opposed to 1/3. And so, in effect, if I test internal controls, I get to one-half the amount of work that I would be doing. Now, if I have only done implementation, and so I am at less than 3, that depends. 2.9, 2.8, 2.3. Can I go below 2.3? I don't know. If in your judgment you can, as long as you're not 1.9, you would be complying with the standards through that. You might want to question some professional judgment associated with that, because it's key that the controls, the way you distinguish between 3 and 2.3 is how effective would that control be, or how important is that control to be implemented. If it's not a very important matter to determining that the items are going to be done right, then I probably can't get below moderate, I probably can't get even to moderate, but I can get to 2.9. And so the idea is that since I'm going to have to do walkthroughs, I ought to go ahead and take advantage of them. I ought to take credit for having done that work. Remember, I have done analytics, I've done observation, and I've done inquiry. That is, in fact, auditing. And to the extent that I'm spending the time to do this walkthrough, I should take credit for it. I should be able and comfortable to take credit for it as part of my professional judgment in this matter to figure that part of it out. All right, we are now in the area of risk assessment. Bill, if you would please take that.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks. The risk assessment process, in our experience, both Chris and I indicate this is where we have our best opportunity for gaining efficiencies in implementing the new risk suite of standards. This is where you apply the information you've learned in your information gathering stage of the planning process or your initial planning procedures. You've had a planning meeting, possibly with the client, possibly without the client, to understand their views of the risks of the entity. Generally, you've performed your walkthroughs at this point, and hopefully you've completed your planning analytical procedures to get an idea, at least preliminarily, of what your account balances look like. Now you move on to design your responses to those risks. And it's in designing these responses that, again, we step back and take a fresh look this year, given the new standards, and say, okay, you know, in areas that we considered higher risk in the past due to a quantitative measure may not appear as risky once you've gone through the what-could-go-wrong process, which we'll talk about in the next slide. But, you know, once you've done that, If you've done that properly, you should be able to identify areas for efficiency in your substantive testing plan or your designed audit programs that would help you achieve a more effective audit while also possibly reducing time incurred from previous years. And so, you know, in this risk assessment process, this is where you ask yourself, what can go wrong? You know, you look at each transaction class and account balance and disclosure and ask, you know, what would lead to an error in this particular cycle? What would lead to an error in the recording of this account balance or the generation of the disclosures in the financial statements? Where are the possible misstatements? You know, to repeat a statement made earlier, auditing is about uncertainty, not certainty. If you know it's gone wrong, or at least it's not right, this is where you can provide an accounting engagement to assist your client in correcting the problem. Or at a minimum, if you can't get your client to agree to that, you know, they can step back and fix the problem before you come back in and try to fix it through auditing procedures. Too many times as auditors, I think we try to plow through these accounts that we know are wrong, and we try to fix them by identifying the differences and proposing correcting entries for the client to record. So if you can perform a non-audit engagement, an accounting assistance engagement instead, you have a chance to move hours out of the audit engagement and into the non-audit engagement and thereby change the nature of the way we approach known problems. Again, if you know it's wrong, it doesn't make a lot of sense to attack it from an audit perspective without getting your client to at least agree to try it themselves or to allow you to fix it outside the scope of the original audit agreement. If your answer to a certain account or assertion is that something could go wrong, but you don't know if it has, then you need to start to select the appropriate procedures to address that risk. You know, here, you look at the balance, it appears right, but do you know that there are certain things in the control system, in the client's business, and the environment they operate in, the people they have accounting for the transactions, something could go wrong. And you try to put a
you try to put a framework around, not a framework, but you try to put some understanding around that, what could go wrong. You try to quantify that to a certain extent. As Chris said, there are opportunities here where control testing may be a more efficient response to substantive testing. If you run through your sampling methodology and you come up with 150 confirmations, but you've got a daily control that deals with the existence of accounts receivable, it might make more sense to test that control over the existence and thereby take the reduction that a low control risk allows you in your sample size on receivables. You can also do substantive analytical procedures. A properly designed substantive analytical could possibly yield more audit evidence or better audit evidence than a straight test of detail and may be easier to perform. And remember, auditing is cumulative. As Chris said in talking about the walkthroughs and the analytics and everything in the planning process, the new standards are fairly clear on this. Auditing procedures are cumulative in nature. You can take credit for what you've done now in the planning process, which to some of us is a different interpretation of planning procedures in years past, where we went, we planned, we gained some information, but then we set out to do the audit in the next step. The new standards recognize that auditing procedures begin the day you begin your risk assessment procedures and your planning procedures for those risk assessment procedures. As you do analytical procedures, as you do walkthroughs, that's audit evidence that you can build into your other decisions for substantive testing at year end. And again, when you think about what is the appropriate procedure to use, when you determine that something could go wrong or has gone wrong, it may be a combination of substantive tests, analytical procedures, or tests for controls. It may be just one. Typically, if it is just one, it's going to be a substantive test of details. If you identified it as a significant risk, and the other type of risk, you could use substantive tests or analytical procedures if they're designed properly. And now, again, to move to the chart that Chris is talking about, in determining our sample sizes, one of the things that we've also found as we've revisited our audit methodology is we probably were not taking enough credit for other substantive procedures performed in designing our sample sizes. So we've moved from the risk of material misstatement column to the other procedures risk. As you see, it's highlighted with the high, moderate, low. When designing a sample, it's important to remember that our other substantive procedures can also reduce your risk of misstatement. So while you could be stuck on high because you weren't able to test controls or your walkthroughs didn't give you enough comfort to get beyond the high-risk material misstatement, you can still drive your sampling sizes down by other substantive procedures. These other substantive procedures may have been done in your risk assessment process, or they may have been done in related accounts, such as cutoff procedures will gain you comfort, cost on inventory, cost of goods sold, and AP, depending on how you design your cutoff procedures. The same thing on the receivable side. If you get your shipping orders and you trace them to the billing records and you look at the accounts receivable ledger, you've got some cutoff comfort on revenue, you've got some cutoff comfort on receivables. So the more reliance you can place on these other procedures, the more you can lower your sample size. And, of course, as you move down the scale of risk of material misstatement, that's when you can really see the benefit of taking credit for these other substantive procedures risks. Well, one thing to notice about the box is that generally you would not want to reduce your factor below 0.9 unless there's, unless you design tolerable misstatement to correctly deal with the standards, the way tolerable misstatement is dealt with in our practice aids. Tolerable misstatement is not necessarily the same concept as is communicated in the new risk standards. So be careful when you use a posting scope that winds up below your assessed risk of material misstatement. You can have a posting scope somewhere between tolerable misstatement and risk of material misstatement, but you really can't have it below your planning materiality or your RMM. So I think with that, we move on to the tailored audit programs.
Sure. Let's again take a look back at this risk chart, if you will. The idea is that we have a top line here which deals with other substantive procedures risk, which can, if we do that and we take no credit for walkthroughs, that is, we're not satisfied that the client has implemented any controls that would be useful in reducing the audit risk, but we can have analytical review procedures that would allow us, to the extent they're very effective with respect to what we're trying to accomplish, the objective and the account we're trying to deal with there, to get us to the same number. You notice the 1.9 low with respect to the other substantive procedures risk is the same as the 1.9 low when we're dealing with only the internal control consideration. And so we can achieve, in effect, the same benefit by using analytical procedures that we can achieve by determining whether the internal control is effective and in place. Now, let's put those in combination. And so when you put them in combination, you can see that I can use a moderate control risk and a low other standard procedures risk and achieve 1.2, which gives me a multiplier with respect to my sampling size, if you will. Instead of one-third, I'm now using about, what would that be, 80%, something like that? 12 would be 18, right? Be about that number, 82%, I think. And I can't believe I can do math like that. No way, right? So in any event, we have that opportunity is there. And so when you are looking at the information, when you're looking at your results here, and you see 1.2 in that column, and you see it again in the other substantive procedures moderate low column. And so if I can drive to the other substantive procedures, they may be more cost effective than trying to achieve my 1.2 rate through the internal control testing. And that's an economic decision. That's not just an audit question that you're dealing with there. That becomes an economic question about how much time am I going to be spending doing this audit in order to gather this evidence that I need to be reasonably assured that the financial statements fairly present. And so the manner in which I go about it needs to vary. And the new standards are very cognizant of that effect, and they, in fact, give us a lot of new tools now that we can apply to be able to move from our 3 risk down to the 1.2 risk that is going to be a lot more efficient. And again, if I'm only going to, if the change is from sending out 10 confirmations to sending out 5, then maybe I don't need to be doing this work in this manner. It may not be cost effective. And analytics are not required if I'm doing sufficient substantive testing to be assured. And if 10 confirmations give me sufficient confidence that the information is fairly presented, then I may not need to be doing that. So it's an economic decision that you need to make on every audit as to whether or not you're going to consider applying internal control testing and to consider whether or not you're going to use analytics to be able to reduce the substantive testing size of it. Now, this does not change the analytical review opportunities available in a non-sampling. So to the extent that you can use that even when you're not sampling something to achieve audit evidence, then you need to be using that and doing those analytical procedures as a part of that. All right, brings us to the tailored audit programs part of it. But we now have to assess risk at the account level and at the assertion level. That means, for instance, for cash, not only do we have to look at cash, but we have to look at existence, completeness, valuation, rights and obligations, and disclosure. I believe I got them all. I hope so. In any event, the new standards, to the extent cash, new standards require that to the extent cash is material and the completeness assertion is relevant, then I need to do some test with respect to it. It doesn't tell me what I have to do, so I would suggest something, for instance, like for the existence objective. So if I can compare the balance per the bank statement to the balance per the books, my expectation is that the balance per the books would be less because I would expect outstanding checks to exceed deposits in transit. And to the extent that it is not materially different, then I may have sufficient competent evidential matter. That would be particularly true if it's as a result of my implementation testing, that is my walkthroughs, I had made a determination that the accounting system was pretty effective with respect, or was pretty good. I can't use the word effective because that implies that I did internal control testing, but it has been implemented and that my inherent risk and my control risk is at moderate, and so therefore that analytic may provide sufficient competent evidential matter to assure me that cash is not, does not cause the financial statements to be materially misstated. If, on the other hand, cash is a very large balance and has events going on that that give it a higher inherent and a higher control risk, then I may need to employ other substantive procedures, which might be include something like testing the deposits in transit. And if I'm satisfied that that would give me the satisfactory evidence, then I can stop there. I may still not be satisfied. I may want to do something with regard to outstanding checks, and that's okay because it's all about auditor's judgment. You have to do three things in cash through operations to be satisfied. And here's some people chuckling out there. I believe you've heard this before. You have to do three things in cash through operations. You have to confirm receivables. You have to observe inventory, and you have to confirm investment. Everything else is negotiable. And what these new standards are about is the process of negotiation with the audit team to see what it is that they're going to have to do to be able to determine that the financial statements fairly present. And that, folks, is the heart of these tailored audit programs, is to assess the risk at each account and for each assertion to make sure that you have done that level, done that properly. Once again, auditing is about uncertainty. To the extent that you know that something is incorrect, then take it outside of the audit procedures, conduct an accounting engagement, have the client fix it, do whatever is necessary so that that does not interfere with your audit process, so that you can deal with the idea of uncertainty. You can deal with the risk of something going wrong as opposed to the certainty that it is wrong inside the audit part of it. You only have to design audit tests to address the risk of material misstatements, and to the extent then that the cash balance is not material, then it may be possible for you to do a lot less than the 26 cash steps that exist in the standard audit program for the performance of, for the audit of cash to do that. And so to be able to identify what that risk is what the heart of it is. And in our firm, we talk about a bottom-up program, audit program, and a top-down audit program. A bottom-up program is where we look at an account with a blank piece of paper, and we say, what can go wrong? And once I identify that, what am I going to do to see if, in fact, it has gone wrong? What am I going to do about that uncertainty? And I design a or multiple audit tests that will make the determination that when those steps are performed, I will know with reasonable assurance that that account is fairly presented and that account is fairly correct. And that's the step. I can also start with a top-down program. And that's what we've all done in the past, where we print out the standard program and we go and perform the work. And there's nothing wrong with that. What we're now being opportunity to do is to actually, from the top down, to look at that program step, each one of them, and say, do I need to do this in order to be satisfied that cash or accounts receivable or whatever account we're looking at is fairly presented? And what is the objective, and how can I best accomplish that? And to tailor that program so that the staff that are actually performing it have been in communication with the partners and the managers who have understanding of risk and understanding of business processes. And so the team puts together this tailored audit program so that they can address the risk that exists with respect to that client. In effect, our programs, every single audit program should look different from every other audit program, since every client certainly looks different than all other clients to do that. In these new standards, it becomes very clear, even though it's been there in the past, it's very clear in the new standards, that we also have to perform substantive tests for revenues and expenses. That is, to the extent it is relevant and material, then we have to do testing of it. And I would suggest that revenues are certainly material and expenses are certainly material to a fair presentation of the financial statement. And so one or more of those assertions, that is, completeness, existence, et cetera, of those standards, of those objectives are applicable inside both revenues and expenditures. Now, what we have done in the past, I think, intuitively, if not directly, is to say, you know what, we're out there confirming accounts receivable. And by virtue of confirming accounts receivable, I have done some substantive testing on the revenue accounts. Because, you know, one of the nice things about accounting is that the debit's equal to credit. Thank goodness, I would have had a hard time in my career if it was any more difficult than that. So, but in this case, we know that the accounts receivable represent that. Now, is that sufficient testing? If accounts receivable turn over once a year, then yeah, sure, that's probably sufficient testing. If, on the other hand, accounts receivable turn over 12 times a year, then only substantively testing 1/12 of the revenue may not be sufficient competent evidential matter with respect to revenues for the entire year. And so I'm going to need to be able to figure out what else it is that I need to do. Perhaps analytics are sufficient for me. In some cases, it may become more appropriate to perform detailed substantive testing with regard to revenues. If I've got a client that only sells 12 widgets a year and they only owed for one of them, then accounts receivable confirmation may not be sufficient competent evidential matter with respect to the revenues. And so I need to go and look back at those other 11 sales that they had and do some substantive testing on them. Maybe do some control testing. Maybe do some analytics. Maybe a combination of all of the above, depending on the nature of the client and what that client is doing, what its accounting processes are, and the determination that I made in planning of what can go wrong. Then I need to figure out what I'm going to do on revenue. The same thing with respect to expenses. It may be that taking a sample of 25 expenditures and seeing that they were properly authorized and properly classified may be sufficient competent evidential matter for the expenditures as a whole, particularly if I'm doing a lot of substantive work in accounts payable, which is the other side of the expenditure account. If, however, I look at that and that may not be sufficient competent evidential matter with respect to all of the relevant assertions on all of the material balances, and so it may be appropriate for me to design other substantive testing with respect to revenues or certain revenue accounts to be able to achieve that and make sure that we have done that testing. So with respect to the inventory testing, that's one place we've always looked to see if there's inventory and cost of goods sold. The same analogies exist with respect to that as we had earlier with the revenues being related to accounts receivable. And so I need to look at that. And many of our clients, for inventory is really not material with respect to the expense section of the financial statements, and so there may be no assurance on substantive testing. This is a new area for many of us, and I think that we're going to have to be thoughtful about it as we deal with it in the first few audits that we perform this year to make sure that we are achieving the standards that are set in these new risk assessment standards with respect to the substantive testing in the revenue and expenditure accounts. Analyticals are probably a more cost-effective way of achieving audit assurance. However, we need to make sure that they are precise enough in the results that we are able to be able to rely upon them. We cannot use them by themselves with respect to a material account balance. The standards are pretty clear about that just like I cannot use internal control testing to eliminate other audit procedures, I cannot use analytical procedures to eliminate substantive testing of material account balances. But I can use them to augment that, as we saw in the earlier slide with respect to our determination. I can do a lot less work at the when I'm doing some substantive procedures. I mean, when I'm doing analytics, I can certainly reduce my other substantive procedures importantly in whatever I'm doing. And so making sure that I've added the right analytics is the program would be important. Now, you remember that in the programs that many of us use, there are currently no analytical procedures included in cash through operations. Analytics, remember, as substantive testing, are not of an account ledger, of a general ledger account balance. They are a test of the underlying that supports that. And so that's what a good analytic is that it does not use a general ledger account balance. It proves a general ledger account balance to do that. So we're able to achieve these additional efficiencies as part of our tailing of audit program by recognizing by understanding the industry, by understanding the business, and by recognizing where the risks are, we can identify some analytical procedures and develop expectations with respect to what results should be in any area to be able to do those. You can certainly use them to attest account balances that are less than materiality, and they're an important element of our repertoire of resources and opportunities available to importantly reduce the amount of work that we're doing on our audits. We've talked a good bit, I think, about this controlled testing to reduce the sample size, make sure that you're looking at it from an efficiency standpoint. That is that to the extent that we do controlled testing, it should reduce the total audit time. If it does not, we need to be looking whether or not it adds value to our client service. And if we're not satisfied that the additional time is repaid in the perception by the client of the value of the work that we're doing for them, then I think you might want to take a look at that and consider it in that context. We're missing a slide. Stick with me just a moment. Oh, I have a polling question. We have another polling question to do that. What we want to know now is to whether or not the presentation has changed your perception about the opportunity for efficiency in the new standards. We know there's a lot of additional work that we're going to have to do, but I hope this has opened your eyes to some of the opportunities, in fact, that do exist in these new standards to figure out how to do things. I see some of you that are saying no and are undecided. At the end of the session, we'll give you an email or a site location that you can go to post some questions at that will hopefully allow us to do that. In addition, those of you that are indicating that you're undecided or have some concerns about whether or not there's going to be efficiencies in this thing, I would also ask that you consider the opportunity to ask questions inside this presentation that we as we conclude it. What I want to do now is to speak about something that is slightly outside of the new standards, and it has to do with communication with management. When I say slightly outside, that is the new standards, the 104 through 111, and what I want to speak to is FAST 112 on the communication of material weaknesses and incentive deficiencies, and the new FAST 114 on communication with management and those charged with governance. And so the idea of that is that we can use that opportunity to communicate to management all these new things that we have now learned as a part of all these additional procedures that we're going to have to be doing and as a part of this better and more focused testing that we've been doing so that we can actually use that opportunity to add value. I've told the people in our firm that I don't ever want to give a client something that they don't think is valuable. And I'm very concerned that if I give them the boilerplate letter for SAS 112, Communication of Significant Deficiencies, that they will look at that and not think much of it and will not read it, particularly the second time I give it to them. More importantly, the SAS 114 communications, those 10 or 11 items that we're required to communicate to a client about now, if we use that form, then I'm very concerned that the client may not perceive that that is valuable and would discard that item rather than use it as part of to do that. So I want to use that opportunity to add value. I want to put that communication in a form that management recognizes the value of it. And now clearly if you've got an audit committee or an outside group that's looking at it, then the form is probably what is most valuable to them. But if you have no outside owners, if management and governance are the same in your enterprise and you have to make these communications, then I would suggest that you use that opportunity to add some value to the services that you're providing for. As part of your planning meeting, look for opportunities to add items to an exit conference agenda, to a communication means that you're going to be, whatever it is that you're going to be using here. Figure out up front what it is you want to look for to be able to do that. And to tailor that boilerplate, even in those cases where you have to send it to an audit committee or to others that are charged with governance and are not a part of management, to make sure that you use that boilerplate in a way that is pertinent and relevant to them and so that these items that they have are not only satisfying the generally accepted auditing standards, but that also something that are very valuable to your clients. In conclusion, we do want to thank you for listening to us today. We will open it up now, I believe, for questions. And as we take those... Don, will you give us the procedures for that, please?
If you want to post any questions to the question manager in the box in the lower right-hand corner, and we'll initially start with some questions that way. And once we've got some questions going in that question box, we may open this up as well, some questions live. And it looks like we do have one question from earlier on.
I think, okay, one of the questions we got during the presentation is for new engagements obtained subsequent to year-end, is the fact that your walkthrough was not done during the period under audit a problem? And I think Chris addressed this during his walkthrough section when he said that the idea is to walk through transactions to verify that controls were implemented during the period under audit. And to the extent that you can achieve this by looking at transactions and controls that you feel comfortable were in effect during a period under audit, yes, you can accomplish this subsequent to year end. If there's been major changes in information technology, process, procedures, otherwise, from year end to the date of your appointment, then you may have a bit more of an issue, and you may need to gather evidence about control implementation through a different means other than walkthrough. Chris, do you have anything you want to add to that?
No, I think that was
fine. It looks like we have a second question that just came in.
In regards to walkthroughs, are you only performing walkthroughs for key risk areas or for significant transaction classes? The standards talk about significant transaction classes, and for the relevant assertion. And so when you're dealing with that, what you need to deal with it without regard to the key risk areas. Now, in the key risk areas, you may want to focus your walkthrough to deal with a particular perceived risk. For instance, if you're doing a walkthrough of revenue recognition in an enterprise where those principles are more complex than just sending it out the door, then your walkthrough needs to recognize that as part of the risk of that particular area and focus on where the risks are in that area to figure out whether the controls or that are relevant to that assertion have in fact been implemented. That will tell you to the extent that they have or have not, that will modify your assessment of that risk. Because a key risk area, if you only have one day to do the audit, what are you going to focus on? Then you certainly want to make sure that you understand very well the controls which are in place and whether or not they have in fact been implemented in that particular area.
I would add to that, Chris, that you're doing your walkthroughs to understand or to identify your key risks within those transaction classes. So if you follow the planning timeline, at least the way our firm has put it together, your key risk assessments don't start to sort of populate themselves until you've finished walking through your specific transaction classes. But I think you're right in that you would provide some emphasis on higher risk areas that just intuitively you know, such as revenue recognition, maybe processing of complex inventory and so forth. You would focus more on trying to identify what the client is doing around those areas that tend to be riskier than just straight invoicing and processing of normal goods and shipments.
Next question. It is my understanding that we are not required under the new standards to test controls except for those in relation to significant risk areas such as estimates. Is this correct? Actually, the new standards do not require you to test controls except in a very narrow circumstance, and that is only where substantive procedures are not adequate to give you sufficient confidence. Then you would have to test controls. So I would suggest that in the environment that most of us operate in, that's probably not going to be the case. And so there is no requirement under these standards to test controls. The only time that you would consider doing it, under the standards at least, is when it would reduce your total audit time in it. So to the extent that there are significant risk areas such as estimates, the idea of testing controls in that is a very good one, by the way, and that might be a very important part of it to make a determination as to the amount of work that you're going to do in that estimate. So if I can test controls, and by virtue of that, I can reduce the total time that I'm going to spend testing that estimate, then I would suggest doing it. Otherwise, unless you need that in order to obtain some assurance, that you're simply saying that my substantive testing is not enough. And so that would be the cut of it. That would be the focus, I think, that you would need to apply to figure out whether or not to test controls.
I'd like to ask something about the significant risk concept of the new standards. One of the things that as our firm went through the process of adopting the new risk suite of standards, we saw this term significant risk, and we became a bit nervous thinking this was going to drive up a lot of substantive testing. We saw the guidance that under significant risk, you have to do a combination of test controls, test the standard details, or perform substantive analytical procedures. As we went, as we've gone through planning for some of our bigger jobs earlier in the planning period, mainly last month, we started to see that, in fact, last year, an area that we consider a significant risk under the new standards this year, we already did some combination of test of details and substantive analytical procedures or test of controls. So that in this case, even though we designated as a significant risk under the new standards, it did not necessarily result in additional work because we had done a risk assessment similar to what the standards had already asked for. And as I talked to other practitioners, they're starting to come to the same conclusion that if you designed your audit properly last year to deal with your higher risks, let's say your more elevated risks, you probably did more than just one test around that risk, particularly as it relates to revenue recognition, which is always sort of de facto high-risk area, significant management estimates that have a lot of uncertainty or a lot of judgment involved in it. You would do more than one type of test around that risk. And so don't let the phrase significant risk automatically push you into doing more work. Assess what you did last year and ask yourself, is this still a sufficient amount of work under the new standards? Okay, even if you do not test controls, if based on your walkthroughs you think controls in an area are good, you can assess risk below max, correct. Also, if inherent risk is low, can that also justify using something below 3 in the chart you presented? I think this is exactly what Chris is getting to. You know, remember that below max, in the firm I was in, there was this concept of the continuum. You know, you were involved in a continuum between maximum and low. And where you fall in that continuum of below maximum is a matter of auditor judgment. So as you go through the walkthroughs and you're certain that the walkthroughs have been implemented properly or the controls have been implemented properly, then you can start to move down below that 3.0. Can you get to the 2.3? And again, Chris addressed this directly in the presentation. It's a little harder to justify getting all the way down to 2.3, but definitely you can use something below 3 in the chart that we presented. Maybe it's 2.9, maybe it's 2.8, but remember now, we're only focusing for this question on the risk of material misstatement. You know, that column that goes high, moderate, low down the left side, as opposed to the other substantive procedure risk, which goes out towards the right.
The idea there is, and what we're talking about is using it to reduce the sample size, in effect. And there are other ways to apply this box, but what we're focused on here is sample size, remember. And so if you've determined that your individually significant items are one-third, and that but divided into the total population or all over that size in the population tells you how many you're going to have to look at, if you take that number to one-half, then your number is, well, you're going to be looking at less. You're going to be dealing with fewer. And the reason you're going to be dealing with fewer is because you are satisfied that the controls have been implemented, and therefore there is less risk, and so you can audit fewer transactions, you can audit fewer balances associated with that.
Next question, so a walkthrough is sufficient to reduce your control risk to moderate? I think we pretty much addressed that. I'd say
it depends.
It depends.
you'd have to spend a hard time thinking about it to get that load down the continuum, but it does depend.
I would tell you that under the standards, you are able to reduce it to more than low. You cannot reduce it to low under the standards. So therefore, you can reduce it to more than low. And that's a matter of professional judgment as to how important is this control with respect to the account balance and assertion that you're dealing with. And if it's a really good control that has been implemented, then you can be more than low. How much more than low? Are you at 2.0 or 2.1 or 2.8? It is a continuum, and it's very much a matter of professional judgment. And the documentation standards will take you to documenting why you think it is 2.0 or 2.9 or wherever on the continuum you end up with respect to the credit that you're going to take for a control having been implemented, that you've identified that through your walkthrough process.
Are you required to perform walkthroughs each year? Do the standards specify how long you can rely on your prior year walkthroughs if there were no changes to the internal control processes? It's my understanding that walkthroughs are required each year insofar as you have to gain an understanding of whether or not the control system or the controls that you document your understanding of prior year have changed in the current year. So if you've done control testing and you elect to try to rely on that control test from the prior year, you still have to go through some process to ensure that those controls did not change in years 2 and 3. So you know, there are other ways of gaining understanding that controls have been implemented, but walkthroughs are the most efficient way of doing that generally. And so, yes, walkthroughs would be required each year.
Yes, exactly. And you can see that again, even though it may not be very specific in the literature. Literature talks about in every audit you have to do a walkthrough. The literature also talks about that in every audit you don't have to test internal controls every year. Right? And so that's the specificity of it, is that the SASs are about auditing standards for an audit, and it says then, so therefore in every audit you will do a walkthrough.
Okay, looks like the last question. If the client has no documentation of their control systems, do you consider this to be a deficiency to be significant under SAS 112? Boy, y'all gonna love this answer. I think it depends. It depends on the nature of the organization. It depends on how much the organization understands what they need to do. The fact that they would have no written documentation would cause me initial pause and concern, but as an auditor, I want to make sure that they know what they're doing, that they're processing transactions properly, that they're summarizing the transactions correctly in the financial statements and making the proper disclosures. And if they haven't written this documentation, I don't think that in and of itself is a significant deficiency or a material weakness under 112. I think it's evidence that needs to be considered. If you encounter other problems, I think that might push you over the edge. But in and of itself, I'd have to really default back to the famous auditor answer of it depends.
I think you can look at what you're doing. If as a result of this client not having any documentation of their control system, if this client who has no documentation of their controls or their systems, and so you either have a lot of audit adjustments or you have to enter into a separate accounting engagement in order to get the financial statements correct, then I would suggest that there's some likelihood that there is a problem, a SAS 112-type problem, with their control systems as a result of not having documentation. And so I would look to it not as an absolute, but look at it on a relative basis. What are you finding elsewhere in your audit? As part of it. And a bunch of adjustments is a key indicator that not having written controls might be the problem there. That might be, to use a peer review term, that might be part of the systemic reason that you're having to do all these adjustments to do that. Well, I see by the clock on the wall that our 100 minutes of CPE credit has been achieved, and we have answered the last question. So I'm going to turn it over to Don now for concluding comments.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Greg. Appreciate you guys. Did a great job. Again, to reiterate what I said in the beginning, we're actually going to send out an evaluation after this. Again, please fill it out and let us know how we did. We're also going to send out a copy of the PowerPoint as well, so everybody will have that. And any questions come up in the future, please log into the Insurance Services section website and feel free to ask anybody on the leadership team. And otherwise, thank you very much.